Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're plunging into a really fascinating and honestly sometimes unsettling legal case out of Kansas, State v. Maxim. This case throws a sharp light on the tricky intersection of financial exploitation, mental vulnerability, and the very precise definitions of theft under the law.
Yeah, it really does.
What makes this case so significant for you to understand, especially as law students, is how narrowly theft can actually be defined, even when someone vulnerable is clearly, you know, being taken advantage of.
It's a case that really makes you think about how our legal system grapples with protecting those most susceptible to exploitation. The surprising thing here, I think, is that even really clear exploitation of a vulnerable person doesn't automatically equal theft under those sort of traditional definitions.
Absolutely. And at the heart of this is Bea Berkman. She was an elderly widow navigating life with bipolar disorder after her husband passed away.
Right.
Sadly, during what the court documents actually describe as her vulnerable giving periods, Bea ended up transferring a significant chunk of her assets.
And we're talking a lot here.
Oh, yeah, over $600,000. That included her house, a truck, substantial cash. All went to the Maxim family. And when we mention bipolar disorder, it's relevant because it can involve these periods of heightened mood and impulsivity, which the court called giving periods.
A truly significant amount.
Yeah.
It immediately raises red flags about the circumstances, doesn't
yeah.
it? It really highlights the need to look beyond just the transaction itself and consider, you know, the context of Bea's vulnerability.
Exactly. So the state brought several charges against the Maxims: theft by deception, theft by unauthorized control, and mistreatment of a dependent adult.
The main ones, yeah.
And this is where it gets really interesting, because the outcomes for these different charges were, well, let's just say they weren't uniform.
Not at all.
So our mission today is to unpack how the Kansas Supreme Court drew distinctions between these legal definitions, especially given Bea's clear vulnerability. We'll be asking, where does the law actually draw the line between what looks like awful exploitation and legally defined theft?
It's such a crucial distinction, and the Maxim case gives some very clear, though maybe surprising, answers. It really forces us to think about what makes something a crime in the legal sense versus just, you know, unethical behavior.
Okay, let's dive in, starting with theft by deception. Now, this might seem like a slam dunk, right? Vulnerable person persuaded to hand over a fortune.
Didn't think so.
But the court actually reversed this conviction. Why? What was the key reasoning there?
Well, what's fascinating is the court's really strict interpretation of Kansas law on this. They emphasized the prosecution had to prove a specific false statement made by the Maxims that directly deceived Bea and, crucially, induced her to transfer her assets.
Induced her. Okay.
Yeah. It wasn't enough that their overall actions might have seemed manipulative or that Bea was vulnerable. They needed that specific lie.
So it wasn't just about general shadiness or, like, taking advantage. They had to pinpoint a concrete lie that directly led to the transaction.
That's exactly the legal interpretation they applied. The court looked at the evidence, and while there was talk about these ghost stories, tales about Bea's dead husband,
right,
they found no direct causal link between those stories and Bea's decisions to actually transfer her property. The state couldn't prove she relied on a specific falsehood when she signed over the house or gave them cash.
Wow, that's a critical distinction. So even if the Maxims were being, let's say, less than honest or ethical overall, if there wasn't a provable lie that directly caused her decisions, the theft by deception charge couldn't stand. That really shows how specific the legal requirements can be.
That's the heart of it. As the court put it, the state must prove a false statement that deceived the victim and induced reliance. That highlights just how vital that element of causation is in fraud and deception cases, at least under Kansas law. It's not enough to just show someone was taken advantage of. You have to prove they were deceived by a specific falsehood that made them act.
Right. Okay, so if proving a direct lie was the hurdle there, what about the idea that the Maxims just took control of her assets without proper authorization? That brings us to theft by unauthorized control.
Mm-hmm.
This one also got reversed, which again might seem counterintuitive given Bea's vulnerability and just the sheer scale of it all. What was the court's logic there?
This is where the court drew a very fine but legally significant line. Even though Bea's consent to these transfers was clearly influenced by her mental state, by the Maxim's actions,
clearly,
the court emphasized that Kansas law for this specific charge requires no consent at all. It doesn't just require wise consent or unimpaired consent. It has to be no consent.
Okay, hold on. So even if her judgment was clouded, as long as she technically agreed, even if under pressure or due to her condition, it doesn't meet the legal definition of unauthorized control for a theft charge.
That's basically it. Think of it like this. Someone taking your car without asking versus maybe being pressured into selling it for way less than it's worth.
Okay, yeah.
In the first case, clearly no consent. In the second, while the decision wasn't smart and maybe there was undue influence, there was still some form of agreement. The court essentially said that poor judgment, even when made worse by a mental health condition, doesn't automatically mean a complete lack of legal capacity to consent to transferring property for the purpose of a theft charge.
Mm-hmm.
They even touched on contractual competence, her legal ability to make agreements or gifts, and noted it wasn't proven she lacked that capacity entirely.
So the court is saying there is a threshold of legal incapacity that just wasn't met here for the theft charge, even though she was obviously vulnerable to influence. It feels like the law has a specific, maybe high baseline for what counts as consent in these theft scenarios.
Precisely. And the court's quote on this was pretty direct. Mental deficiency alone doesn't negate consent for theft. This is a really crucial nuance for understanding how the law works in these complex situations. It just underscores that the bar for proving a complete lack of consent in a theft case is quite high.
Fascinating, and yeah, maybe a little unsettling. So if both theft charges were reversed, how were the Maxons held accountable? That takes us to the third charge, mistreatment of a dependent adult. This is where the convictions were upheld. Tell us about that.
Right. And this is where the legislative intent to protect vulnerable adults really comes into focus. Mm-hmm. The specific Kansas statute for mistreatment of a dependent adult, it's KSA 213437, is designed precisely for situations like B's, where someone, because of mental or physical limits, can't protect themselves and is then exploited.
Okay.
The court found that the Maxons clearly took unfair advantage of B's vulnerable giving periods, which were, you know, directly linked to her diagnosed bipolar disorder.
So this statute is specifically aimed at the exploitation of vulnerability itself, even if it doesn't perfectly fit those traditional theft definitions. It's like the law recognizing a different kind of wrong.
Exactly. The court actually highlighted this, saying something like, the legislature intended to criminalize exploitation of vulnerability through the dependent adult statute. This law basically fills the gaps where traditional theft laws might fall short. It addresses manipulative behavior that doesn't necessarily involve a specific lie or a total lack of consent in that strict legal sense. It recognizes that the vulnerability itself can be the means of the crime.
That makes a lot of sense. It's like the law acknowledging someone can be taken advantage of because of their state without being explicitly lied to or forced, especially if their mental state impairs their judgment and ability to protect their own interests. It's about abusing trust or power.
That's a very good way to frame it. The dependent adult statute gets at that abuse of trust and manipulation of vulnerabilities.
Now, there were also a couple of other legal points raised, right? Like one about jury unanimity on the mistreatment charge. Can you briefly explain why that argument didn't succeed?
Sure. The Maxons argued that since the mistreatment could cover multiple individual acts of exploitation, like taking the truck one day, getting cash another day, the jury needed to agree unanimously on which specific acts constituted the crime.
Okay, a multiple acts challenge.
Right. But the court rejected it. They explained that the mistreatment here was a continuous course of conduct. It wasn't just isolated incidents, but a pattern. So the jurors didn't need to agree on every single specific instance. They just needed to agree that this continuous pattern of mistreatment happened.
That makes sense, focusing on the overall pattern rather than getting bogged down in each individual transaction. And finally, Christopher Maxson's sentence, it received an upward departure. Why was that upheld?
The court found significant aggravating factors justified going above the standard sentence for Christopher. They specifically pointed to the systematic nature of the exploitation over time and B. Bergman's extreme vulnerability, which the Maxons knowingly exploited.
So severity and duration played a big role.
Definitely. These factors showed a level of culpability that, in the court's view, warranted a harsher sentence. It really underscores how seriously the court viewed the exploitation, even if some of the theft charges didn't quite fit the legal definitions.
This case really offers some critical nuances, especially for you listening, our law student audience. What are some key takeaways for them from State v. Maxson?
Well, for law students, this is just a prime example of why understanding statutory interpretation is so vital. Look how meticulously the court distinguished between the elements of the general theft statutes and that specific statute protecting dependent adults.
Yeah, the wording really mattered.
Immensely. It highlights that the precise wording and the intent behind each statute are critical. You can't just assume, oh, this feels wrong, it must be theft. You have to match the facts to the legal elements.
Absolutely. It's not enough to see the injustice. You have to analyze if the specific elements of the charged crime can be proven with the evidence. It really forces you to drill down into the legal details.
Exactly. And this case also shows the different evidence thresholds, right?
Yeah.
Proving exploitation under that dependent adult statute focuses on abusing vulnerability, taking unfair advantage. That's different from proving theft by deception, which needs that specific lie and reliance, or theft by unauthorized control, which needs a complete lack of consent. Understanding those different burdens of proof is crucial.
And thinking practically, this case must touch on some really important considerations for prosecutors, too. They have to navigate these fine lines when deciding what charges to even bring.
Oh, absolutely. Prosecutors face this all the time. They need to carefully weigh which charges are not only appropriate, but actually provable given the specific facts and the specific laws. You might feel a strong sense of moral outrage, like in this case, but the charges have to align with what you can legally prove in court.
It's a real balancing act.
It is, seeking justice while strictly adhering to the legal framework. Sometimes the law specifically designed for the situation, like the mistreatment statute here, is the strongest path forward.
So let's wrap up our deep dive into State v. Maxson. What this case really drives home is that while awful financial exploitation of someone vulnerable can happen, it might not always fit neatly into the traditional legal boxes for theft.
Right.
This really underscores how crucial those specific protective statutes are, like the one for mistreatment of a dependent adult, for addressing these more nuanced situations where vulnerability is the key ingredient in the exploitation. For you, the key is understanding that legal definitions are precise and different laws exist to tackle different kinds of wrongdoing.
It really forces us to think about the boundaries of criminal law and where the legal system needs to step in to protect those who can't fully protect themselves. It shows the law trying to adapt, maybe, to address these complex harms.
And on that note, here's a final thought for you to chew on. Given the complexities we've seen in Maxson, where should the legal line ultimately be drawn between, say, unwise decisions made by someone vulnerable and outright criminal exploitation? How can our legal system best balance respecting individual autonomy with that crucial need to prevent abuse and protect those most susceptible?
That's the big question, isn't it?
It really is. It's something this case leaves us pondering, and it has huge implications for how we, as a society, protect our most vulnerable members. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.